Welcome to Emory Braincast, Emory's psychiatry podcast. My name is Mina Bozak. I'm a resident here at Emory and the host of the show. Here, I interview personalities within the field of mental health. We discuss their interests and expertise and all the exciting things they're doing and see happening in the world of mental health. Every once in a while, I also drop an interview with one of my fellow residents, mentors, or supervisors, just to showcase the Emory personalities. I hope you enjoy what we have to offer. Hello, Braincast listeners. It's been a while. To kick off the return, I've got a great episode with Dr. Brandon Court, a psychiatrist, researcher, anthropologist. And in this episode, we talk about a project we conducted in Liberia a couple of months ago. We talk about Liberia's history, and in addition, Dr. Court shares a little bit of advice for those who are interested in global mental health. It's a short but sweet episode, and I hope you enjoy it.
So I am a psychiatrist and anthropologist, currently working with the Carter Center in Liberia. I've been consulting with the Carter Center since 2010, looking at different cultural aspects of how to best integrate mental health into primary care to reduce stigma, and most recently, how to work with police officers, correctional officers, and immigration officers to educate them about mental health and improve their treatment of people with mental illness in the law enforcement system.
Okay, thank you. How did you get into that?
So I did my residency training at Emory University, and during that time had the opportunity, as the Carter Center was doing its first international program, a proof of concept in Liberia, to see how, after at the point 14 years of civil conflict, you could rebuild a mental health system. So it was all about health system strengthening, focusing on the mental health aspect of it, and it was a very unique program, and they wanted to make sure that the program was culturally appropriate, that was going to be feasible, and a key issue was addressing how primary care workers, community individuals, families, and religious leaders had a lot of stigma against mental health, which is very common around the world, and that stigma was made even worse by the 14 years of war. We met many people who thought that mental illness was the result of bad things that people had done during the war, that if you had killed people, or in some cases if you made deals with Bush doctors or herbalists to survive the war, that now the punishment for that deal was that you would get mental illness. So just a lot of stigma. And so the Carter Center then integrated that into their planning to not just assume, oh, if we teach people about mental health problems, they'll start delivering care, people will come for care, and it'll all work out. So the integration of culture really helped to be sure that this was going to be a successful program with good uptake.
Okay, thank you. For those listening, you will hear a bit of noise in the background. We are at the Liberia National Police Training Academy right now, and there are gunshots in the background. Pat Strode is right next to me, who you'll hear later on in a different interview. And there's a young little girl just walking by. Mommy's in class. So a lot of things going on. Certainly the Civil War led to a lot of the destabilization in the mental health services within Liberia. Can you give people a little bit of context about the Civil War, what happened?
What we see around the world is that the systems of healthcare, community cohesion, the appropriate environment for safe child development are often disrupted by political violence, civil wars, terrorism. And so my work is really focused on that, with a special interest on how kids are affected by these types of context. I initially did a lot of work in Nepal in the late 90s and 2000s with child soldiers, and that led to my interest in collaborating with the Carter Center, because the violence in West Africa, here in Liberia and Sierra Leone, was really one of the worst in recent history in Africa with regard to how widespread and how brutal the violence was. Liberia has a very interesting history, which is intertwined with American history, that Liberia was actually founded by ex-slaves who came from the U.S. over to West Africa, found this as an area that wasn't as densely populated, and basically built their own colony in the early 1800s. These ex-slaves dominated the government and positions of power, access to education and wealth from the early 1800s up to the 1970s. And there was, some issues of resentment, lack of access to power and resources between those individuals who were associated with some of the original ex-slave founders and then indigenous Liberian populations who didn't feel they had the same access to resources. And so in 1980, there was an uprising by Samuel Doe. And at that point, many of the leaders who were associated with the original founder families were brutally executed. There then was basically 14 years of violence with different individuals taking power. Many individuals know the name of Charles Taylor. So Charles Taylor took over after Samuel Doe, and under his rule, the violence escalated even more. And so over 100,000 people were killed during this 14-year war, and many populations were displaced. You had a lot of refugees from Liberia that came to the U.S. at that time, and this violence spread to Sierra Leone, and so you also had a lot of cross-border violence as well. Many people are familiar with child soldiers of Sierra Leone. Liberia also had a huge child soldier problem at that same time. And so then in the early 2000s, you began to have programs to help, rehabilitate children who had been exposed to violence, other aspects of the country, rebuild the health system. And the Carter Center came in with a focus on the mental health side of that program.
Mm-hmm. Now, what is it about conflicts like those that occurred in Liberia that affects mental health services and that increases the need for mental health services? I think PTSD seems to be an intuitive thing, but is there anything else that comes up in these situations?
Mm-hmm. So what you see is just massive disruption of the health system, that this type of violence, you get it in natural disasters as well, but it's far worse with man-made violence, political violence. So the health system's disrupted. Often individuals who have common mental disorders or severe mental disorders, they can't access the care they need to. So often in many of the settings that I work, what you actually see are individuals who may have, their mental health worsened by the trauma, but in large part, it's just individuals who have had ongoing mental health problems who can no longer get access to care. So the disruption of services is one of the biggest parts. Of course, we also see PTSD. An important thing to keep in mind is that the majority of individuals who experience a traumatic event will recover on their own, that we don't need a lot of interventions for response from acute traumas. The problem is that the contexts that experience episodic traumas are also the same contexts that have ongoing traumas and stressors. So you have a traumatic event that's mixed in with chronic poverty, lack of access to education, domestic violence, child abuse, all kinds of other factors. And so the PTSD that we see, after the war here is this confluence of all these pieces. It's not simply the trauma of, you saw somebody get killed, you lost a relative, but really the compounded effect of all of these processes. If one's daily life stabilizes, often we are able through our social systems to recover from a lot of traumatic events. The problem is when you're living through 14 years of civil war, how does your life stabilize? That's just not possible. So I met many individuals who had to, who got displaced, who had to move to other parts of the country, who had to move to Sierra Leone or Guinea, and as a result of that, they weren't attached to their own homes. They had to then come back and get resettled. So there was just massive disruption in addition to widespread exposure to violence.
Okay, I see we have another reporter here. I'm going to pause this up here, and guys, just so you're aware, the team is going to have to be interviewed by what's the name of the.
Zeze from Bush Chicken.
Zeze from Bush Chicken. So hopefully we'll have time for a little bit more from Dr. Cord. Otherwise, until next time. So Dr. Cord, some of the listeners, a lot of us are trainees who do have interests across the spectrum, and those interests do include public health. For those who are interested in public health, how would you recommend that they get their feet wet, so to speak?
Yeah, I think the most important aspect is absolutely collaboration. Without collaborations, going somewhere, having an experience, getting exposed to something can be interesting, but it can be disruptive because in many settings there are so few resources that somebody coming in to, you know, think that they're helping or think that they're going to contribute in some way may take away from the ongoing service provision, ongoing capacity building, ongoing work just trying to liaise with governments, ministries, healthcare providers. So I think the first thing is to have an ongoing collaboration to be able to do this in an ethical way that ultimately will minimally disrupt ongoing services and programs. So for example, a place like the Carter Center is great because there are internships set up that feed directly into building other aspects of the capacity in the program. So I think first kind of looking for where these things are already in place. We do similar things in Nepal with the organization, Transcultural Psychosocial Organization, or TPO Nepal, where we have now built up a system. People can come in for 2 weeks, they get some language training, they get exposed to some basic field research methods, and then they get embedded into an ongoing project. That way, a student, a resident, a fellow is able to contribute, but also not disrupt the services. If it's a place that's a humanitarian disaster, we often think, oh, this is a place where I can go in and assist. Often in these settings, the logistics of finding a way to help are very, very challenging. And you're also going into places where there's massive disruption in terms of access to water, electricity, shelter. So adding one more body at times can disrupt the access that others need in those moments. So typically, right after a disaster is not the best time to go in and start your global health career. The other issue is going in and direct service provision often isn't the most sustainable. So trying to work with others to do trainings, to help build resource materials, to provide access to other online resources or to build local resources, thinking about the long-term contributions I think is very helpful, and maybe having direct service provision not be a part at all of what you're doing or a very, very minor part. But really trying to, when you leave, feel like there's a little bit more capacity of the folks that you're working with. And then most important part is just being open to learn, that you are going to benefit a lot more from early experiences in this than the people you think you are benefiting. So that humility is probably the best thing to pack when you get on the plane.
Well, that was it. Like I said, it was a short and sweet episode. I hope you enjoyed this one. And if you have any suggestions for us here at Emory Braincast, feel free to email us at emorybraincast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you.